Okay, so yeah, I'll be dealing with the objections to what you've outlined. So I'm looking at the EU's politics of protection and how it's linked to RTP in quite a critical way. So critical that Richard called it polemical when I gave it last time, I believe, which I thought was unfair. But,
soft word as well.
Yeah. Nice. Okay, so basically, I start with the EU's refugee deal, which it struck with Turkey earlier this year, which the human rights campaigners marked a particularly dark and shameful period in the history of the EU. And this comes in the middle of what is widely recognised as a refugee crisis, in which the EU has struggled both internally and externally to control and deal with the flow of people seeking its protection. Okay, so with this in mind, some defenders of RTP, such as yourself, have argued that this evolving norm of RTP might supply the moral guidelines necessary to rescue the EU from its shameful policies. Okay, so maybe the EU can find some resources in RTP. My paper basically argues against that for two reasons. Firstly, the EU itself has a well-rehearsed set of supposedly founding liberal democratic values, which long predate and go way beyond the values that are contained in RTP. Added to that, RTP itself RTP does not contain any guidance or obligations to receive refugees, and shows no signs, as far as I can see, of developing in that direction. So I can't see any signs of this evolution that might be the case. So the duties owed by states to refugees are in fact already dealt with and well established in international humanitarian and refugee law. They're widely accepted, far more widely accepted and entrenched than the RTP norms. Okay, so it's hard to see how it would help the EU in its current situation to engage more thoroughly with RTP. My second argument, though, is that when the logics underlying the EU's protection politics and RTP's protection are explored, a similarity comes out which makes the supplementation of one by the other essentially redundant, as far as I see. Okay, so essentially the way they both work is to privilege not primarily saving people. That's not their main intention. The main intention of both is to save sovereign states, to protect sovereign states. So the priority of both the EU, this must be where the polemic comes in, the priority of both the EU and RTP is the reinforcement of the state. The protection of suffering populations is much more minimalist, much more, so humanitarianism being like a minimalist welfareism, it's a minimalist form of protection. Okay, it's much more constrained than what is offered to the state. So while the EU claims to be a cosmopolitan postmodern polity, and RTP claims to be a substantial normative innovation, in fact, both are deeply conservative and state-centric. So I want to focus on that second element of the argument because I think it's more controversial and might take more explanation. Okay, so the EU and RTP have had a relationship largely of mutual ignorance, right? They just ignore each other for the most part. Okay, so a lot of, so the EU engages in substantial forms of peacekeeping, state building, development, all the elements, especially of pillar two of RTP, okay? And yet none of these policies really refer to RTP at all in justification of their policies. And they've been doing this for years, right? So while individual member states are prominent proponents of the norm, the most powerful EU institutions, the Council and the Commission, have almost entirely ignored it, especially the Commission ignores it entirely. Okay, instead it focuses on the promotion of these key European values, right? Human rights, solidarity, the rule of law, protection of minorities, democracy, equality. Okay, so that's what it does. It goes back to its own values at all times, rather than going to RTP. Meanwhile, the way RTP has developed so far has offered almost no role for regional organizations like the EU. So in the original ICISS report and later UN Secretary General report, they've offered little detail whereby regional arrangements come in. Okay, so they're mainly brought in as a supportive role, okay, in terms of pillar two capacity building measures. Where the Secretary General's report and his reports do pinpoint EU success is in the policy of enlargement. Okay, so the Secretary General specifies that the most successful EU RTP policies have been in relation to the its expansion, its enlargement to encompass formerly communist and war-torn states in its south and east. So in particular, points to the way the EU's membership entry requirements, the Copenhagen criteria, establish the need for democracy, the rule of law, stability, and human rights. Okay, and the Secretary General says this has been the most successful way of pacifying states and helping them to achieve their responsibility to protect. Now, in fact, of course, the enlargement policy is far wider and deeper than R2P. Okay, it goes way beyond what R2P requires. And as the Secretary General says, it has been remarkably successful for the most part, not in the case of the UK. So what becomes apparent, though, when we look at enlargement is that it's not those populations. The enlargement policy doesn't target populations, basically. Its target is states. It doesn't welcome in populations, it welcomes in states. And it's states that it's primarily seeking to protect. Okay, so it's trying to protect those states, those war-torn, conflict-prone states, and most of all, it's trying to protect itself. Okay, so the reason the EU engages in enlargement is in large part because it doesn't want these unstable states falling apart near it. Okay, and producing refugee flows, as happened when Yugoslavia fell apart. Secondly, it wants to protect those states themselves, okay, from themselves, okay? Only thirdly does it want to protect the populations themselves. And you can see this in relation to Bosnia, okay? So in the last 15 years, the EU has engaged in hugely invasive measures in building the state of Bosnia as it sees fit, okay? So this is often against the population's will, against Bosnians' will. So, for example, the EU demands, as part of its enlargement, that a state has a strong central unitary character. Okay. Now, Bosnia is completely diffused federal structure that is dead against what the EU wants. So they've tried to force Bosnia to centralize, okay, against the Bosnian Serb Respublika Srpska's will. Okay. When Respublika Srpska has tried to secede, the EU has said we will not accept any referendum. Okay, so the democratic will of Bosnians does not matter to the EU, even though democracy is one of its key values. Okay, what matters is the Bosnian state. That's primarily what's being saved. Okay, so we can see the same priority as this, the saving of states, the protection of states, operating in R2P. Okay, it's been stressed time and again by the ICISS report and the Secretary General that the aim of R2P is not to weaken sovereign states, but to strengthen them by helping them meet their responsibilities. So in the 2014 report, this was underlined, okay? The aim was to reinforce, not undermine sovereignty. So states are basically supported in Pillars 1, 2, and the non-coercive aspects of Pillar 3. While populations will often be protected by those measures, they're not given any independent agency by R2P. The only actor in all three pillars remains the target state on the one hand, and the UN and its member states on the other. Okay, the population has no role. So we can see the way both the EU and R2P prioritize state protection in this current refugee crisis, the way they're working together with the same logic. Okay, so the EU has been developing its policy towards refugees and migrants since the Tampere European Council in 1999. Where it promised to build a common European asylum system, creating Europe as an area of protection. Now, that Europe as an area of protection isn't spoken of at the moment, okay? But in 1999, that was the aim, to create Europe as an area of protection. And it has done this through 3 5-year programs, which sought to harmonize the standards and processes for seeking asylum in member states. But it also crucially stressed at every stage of these programs, it stressed the development of the asylum system's external dimension. Okay, now in many ways, the external dimension of asylum has seen the most activity, the most cooperation, the most agreement between member states. And this dimension basically involves working in partnership with third countries, i.e. non-member states, as a way of expressing what the EU calls its solidarity with third countries. Okay, so this essentially what this external dimension means then is a vast array of Pillar 2 style capacity building measures, working with third countries to boost their protection capacities and help them move into line with international refugee and migration law. So it aims to help them to live up to their responsibilities to protect, okay, by caring for the displaced populations within their territory. But this external dimension isn't just about care for the displaced. It's also crucially seeking to control their movement, the movement of the displaced. So the capacity building aims to fortify third countries' border controls and their capacity to integrate failed asylum seekers who are deported back from Europe, okay? So that they can more effectively prevent illegal secondary movements by refugees towards Europe. So this is about care and control. It's the classic humanitarianism, care and control, okay? Protection of EU states and third countries and refugees as a kind of byproduct to this. But that's exaggerating it, obviously. It's not just a byproduct, but they're not the primary things being protected, object of protection. So cooperation on this capacity building and border control is now written into every single trade and development agreement signed between the EU and third countries and regions. But that care and control has been most apparent in the central element of the external dimension, what it calls the regional protection programs, or RPPs. Okay, so these protection programs basically help fund UNHCR to build the protection and policing capacity of regions which both produce and transit refugees towards Europe. RPPs were set up originally from 2005, and they targeted Eastern Europe as a transit region and Tanzania, African Great Lakes, as a origin region for refugees. Okay, and in 2010, these were expanded to include the Horn of Africa and Northeast Africa. In 2013, the latest one was announced, a regional protection and development program, which was going to focus on Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq. Okay, this is the destination states for Syrians. Okay, so now you've got RPPs surrounding Europe's southern and eastern borders, those areas that are most problematic. Now, while these agreements contain a resettlement commitment, which I think you're going to come on to, maybe, a bit, they retain a resettlement commitment from EU member states. That's on a voluntary basis, okay, so it actually commits to nothing at all. And very, very few, in fact, almost no refugees have been, we can't actually tell how many have been resettled, but it looks like a remarkably small number have been resettled in this way. So what RPPs are is the EU attempting to outsource its protection, helping states live up to their responsibilities while also preventing refugees getting anywhere near Europe. Outsourced protection ensures then, as former Home Affairs Commissioner Cecilia Malmström put it in 2010, there is essentially no legal way for a refugee to reach Europe. So what we get then is the EU's fundamental value of solidarity being expressed in diminishing concentric circles. Greatest solidarity and protection is expressed between EU member states, who cooperate to ensure that they're not destabilized by coming face to face with the suffering stranger. A secondary solidarity and protection is offered to third countries who have their protection and policing capacities galvanized by the EU. It's only a tertiary, minimalist, humanitarian solidarity and protection that's offered to refugees themselves, on the condition that they don't try and get to Europe. And this is essentially what you see operating in the current Turkey deal. Under this agreement, all new irregular migrants arriving from Turkey after 20th of March, even those from recognized conflict zones, would be deported back to Turkey. For every Syrian returned, a different Syrian refugee would be resettled from Turkish camps into the EU, up to a maximum of 54,000, so this isn't a big number. In return, Turkey received a visa liberalization agreement, accelerated EU membership accession negotiations, a quicker disbursement of 3 billion euros that had already been committed, and a further commitment of an extra 3 billion euros. Okay, so Turkey is now an exceedingly well-funded regional protection program, essentially. Crucially, however, this is nothing. There's nothing in R2P, either in its current form or how it seems to be evolving on my reading, that can offer a criticism of the EU's shameful actions. In fact, R2P's stress on strengthening the state and its protection capacity authorizes the EU's external dimension. Indeed, the EU's generous funding of its outsourced protection, and it is generous, okay, actually makes it a shining example of the way R2P should work. The EU perhaps is the evolution of R2P. Perhaps that's the worrying thing, okay? And by way of conclusion, both the EU and R2P are seeking to bolster the state, okay, building both its traditional sovereignty and protection capacity. In doing so, they secure the borders of wealthy northern states and reproduce a global migration regime that both traps and protects people as near as possible to the conflicts that they're fleeing from. Cheers.